You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe, New Mexican. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. And it's time, ladies and gentlemen, for the legislative preview here on the Radio Cafe podcast for the Santa Fe, New Mexican. I'm delighted to welcome Milan Simonich. He is an editor and columnist here at the Santa Fe, New Mexican. Steve Terrell, who's a columnist and reporter, and reporter Andrew Oxford. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Hey, glad to be here.
So let's take a look forward at the upcoming 30-day legislative session here in New Mexico. And let's a little bit take a look backward, too, because it is Governor Susana Martinez's last legislative session before she leaves office as governor. What would you say is the legacy that she has brought to 8 years of governing on the level of getting laws passed?
Yeah, I think that's really the open question, right? Because a lot of what she pushed, even in her earlier years, hasn't passed or hasn't really, you know, panned out. I mean, obviously she's pushed through tax cuts and things like that, but we still have, you know, I think a lot of that was overshadowed by the sluggishness of the economy, for example, by consistent problems in government, from the education system to the healthcare system. So I think her legacy is really undefined right now. And these next 30 days, it's going to be interesting to watch and see if she tries to salvage a legacy or try to define a legacy in any way.
Well, as Milan pointed so eloquently in this column today, she's going to trot out one of her favorite standbys, crime bills. I refer to the governor as the crackdown governor because she's always going to crack down on some crime or another. And the thing is, like Milan said, I should let Milan talk, but these things have failed in the past. The Democrats are still in charge of the legislature. They're going to fail this year.
I don't believe she has a legacy right now. I wrote that she's in search of a legacy. I'm not sure that she can get one. I suppose one of the things she might attempt to say she's accomplished is shrinking the size of government. There are lots of unfilled jobs in state government, but there's also inefficiency in many departments, understaffing in many departments. She certainly has tried to make crime a centerpiece of what she's done in the last several years, but crime rates have gone up at the same time she's been talking about her methods for reducing crime. The really combating the core causes of crime has not happened under her watch.
I think that's such an interesting and important thing to talk about, namely the root causes of crime versus punishment. What's your perspective on that?
Well, there's a lot of poverty in New Mexico. We all know this. A lot of kids don't get out of high school with a diploma. If you start life that way, your chances of success are small. If you are poorly educated, you don't have any money, crime becomes an avenue that people take. Drugs are a scourge not only in New Mexico but across the country. Combating those is a difficult job. Obviously, governors all across the country struggle with this. The Susana Martinez administration has approached this as we need longer sentences, we need harsher punishments. At the same time, we have a poorly funded court system. The public defender can barely survive. And in fact, in some cases, as said, it cannot even do its job correctly. A public defender might have 200 or 300 clients at a time.
One of the things that I think is not talked about by proponents of the idea of shrinking, quote unquote, shrinking the size of government, is what that means is precisely what you guys are saying. Not that you do away with the role of government, but you just basically put more of a burden on the people whose jobs haven't been cut.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's there's all these unlucky. The late great Lucky Varela, representative from Santa Fe for years and years, used to always harp on that we have not filled all these positions, and it's the positions that legislators have approved to do certain jobs, provide certain services, and a lot of these are left unfilled.
So let's talk for a moment about the crime bills that the governor is trying to put on the agenda for this legislative session. What do they look like? What is she asking for?
Well, obviously, there's the reinstating the death penalty we expect to see come back, but only for certain cases. You know, in the last few years, as she has supported reinstating the death penalty, which the legislature repealed, I think, back in, 2009, it has been tailored towards the death penalty for cases involving the killings of police officers or children or correctional officers. And there are a lot of Republicans, I think, who are uncomfortable with that bill. It passed the House when they had control of it, but it took a lot of doing. It took passing it in the middle of the night, really.
The middle of the night. It was early morning.
It was early morning. I remember I was there, and I went home around 5 a.m. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it dragged on, and there were Republicans who told me afterwards, I don't personally support the death penalty, but I knew this bill wasn't going to go anywhere, and I was able to use it to get something I wanted. Now that Democrats are in control, there's no need, you know, for that kind of, for those kinds of political plays, and so I just think it's going to very quickly get killed in committee. I think you'll see a expanded version of the three strikes law, which is, you know, three violent felony convictions and a life sentence. Those have been really kind of out of fashion in a lot of states over the last several years. A lot of states have done away with these laws or rolled back these laws, arguably because they don't find them effective or they don't have the money to lock up people like that, or in those numbers, or a combination of the two. You might see, you know, some efforts to water that bill down by, you know, by Democrats and make it a little bit more palatable. You'll also see things like an expanded version of, you know, or stiffened penalties for DWI, for child abuse, things like that.
Child porn.
Child pornography, that's right. So, well, you'll see a bunch of sentencing bills. I don't see a whole lot of them passing, maybe a few of the less controversial ones, but generally I think Democrats are most interested in not really getting into this in the governor's last year, or not handling this in the governor's last year, knowing full well that in a year you'll have a different person as governor and maybe a different approach to crime altogether.
Well, and that different approach to crime altogether might be what, Mylon, you were talking about earlier, which is looking at root causes. That's a whole lot harder to address as a society and as a legislature.
Certainly it is. If you're going to have treatment programs, those cost money, but they may catch people early in the process before they have turned to theft and robbery and various other crimes. I think the one point that the governor has made that has some legitimacy in this debate is very few people are in prison simply because they use drugs. But typically people who use drugs to the level of addiction, steal and fence stolen goods, or commit various other crimes. So it is all interconnected, and that part of it has not been addressed by her administration. There was a legislative subcommittee that tried to address that, but most of the work it did over 18 months or 2 years really did not go anywhere. So now we're back to these expanding three strikes, which aren't necessarily even violent crimes under some of the Republicans' proposals. They are just a larger list of crimes. And states like California have found that whenever you put a formula into place, you're going to sentence people automatically for a conviction. There will be problems in that sort of system where you're going to ensnare someone who is 18 years old and was with a couple of people when they mug somebody on a street. And yes, this person has a couple of burglary convictions already, and so you're going to take somebody who's 18 who was did something stupid, and now you're going to turn that into a life sentence. That's why these three strikes laws haven't worked, because states find we're sending people away for at great expense to the public, when the only reason is we had a system that we were relying on instead of letting judges judge. Let judges anticipate and see the differences between defendants.
That's a cycle we've seen for years and years, blaming judges for, you know, giving light sentences or letting criminals go when they shouldn't have, maybe. But the alternative is take things out of the hands of judges and, like Mylon says, make it automatic for somebody for relatively minor crime gets a lengthy sentence. I think the pendulum may have been swinging the other way for a while. This committee Mylon spoke of, the subcommittee, was Democrats and Republicans looking at ways to reduce prison populations, to look at the real root causes of crime rather than just punishment. I think the election of Donald Trump really set back the criminal justice reform effort. You don't even see people talking about that anymore. And it was just a couple of years ago, it seemed like, hey, here's something that both sides can agree on. Maybe we can get something done. But
I think it started before that. I mean, I think in New Mexico, you began to see the pendulum swing in the other direction when you saw, you know, a few particularly, you know, high-profile cases in Albuquerque. You know, whether it was that young girl who was, you know, killed in sort of a road rage incident, or a police officer who was killed. And I think you saw some politicians seizing on those things as.
Oh, yeah. Some politicians, including Governor Susana Martinez.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it became those created a political opening to make this the issue, rather than talking about the things I don't think the governor does want to talk about, which is the economy, which is, you know, education, which is, you know, child welfare, maybe more broadly. So I think it began to swing the other way. I think certainly the election of Donald Trump hasn't helped, and it's kind of, you know, taking even more air.
I'm thinking on the national level, though. I mean, there was really a national criminal justice reform movement, and people like Senator Tarocco, who got defeated for re-election, were wanting to get in on that. And all we have left for the ashes.
But New Mexico is really on the front of that, I think, in a lot of ways. I mean, when you look at the bail reform efforts, for example, I mean, that was, you know, New Mexico was kind of out front on some of these things for a while, and now it's just swung in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
And I think underneath this whole conversation is the question of the people whose lives just get wasted, and it's so often, both in New Mexico and in the rest of the United States, people of color, who young men of color, who came from tremendous disadvantages, as you were saying, and then suddenly they are in jail for a life sentence, and maybe some people deserve that, and maybe a lot of them didn't too. So we will see what happens with the governor's crime bills, and any predictions? Yeah, I guess you guys are saying that they're probably not going to go anywhere.
Yeah, I don't think, especially the bigger ones, the death penalty, the three strikes, maybe they'll do a watered-down three strikes. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that passed maybe last year or so.
Because I know Senator Daniel Ivy Soto, a Democrat, has a bill with Nate Gentry, who's the Republican leader in the House, that has to do with three strikes. It's probably not as extreme as the
right.
others. But I don't know if that has really a chance of passing, though.
Let's talk about education. What kind of education reform is up this session?
I imagine we'll probably see the governor's bill to hold back third graders who do not meet proficiency levels on standardized reading tests. That's been a bill she has had every year since she took office in 2011. It won't pass. Again, it's sort of like the crime bill, where if you make a judgment based on a test and you discount all other factors, including parental involvement, including the opportunity for summer school or tutoring, then you're going to hold back a lot of kids who don't have an advocate. But those bills are always written with exceptions for you can appeal on certain basis. So a kid who has some resources will likely not be held back. Somebody who doesn't know how the system operates would be held back. And there are a lot of legislators, particularly those who have worked in education, like Senator Bill Soles of Las Cruces, who say the data shows that if you hold back kids with a uniform system, you didn't score well enough on a reading test, therefore you must repeat third grade. If you do that, you end up with more dropouts. There is some contradictory data about this, but it doesn't appear that legislators are sold on this idea. Oklahoma had a very rigid system like this. It has retrenched from it, finding that if you hold kids back, you tend to discourage them, particularly at a young age. Everybody who's in third grade knows who's in their class. If you move forward to fourth grade and there are three kids who are still in third grade, they say, you flunked. And so that becomes sort of the stigma even at that age. And if you try to do it in higher grades, holding people back, it is very few people support that, because it just discourages the student. And now, obviously, individual responsibility should begin at a young age, and kids should be held to account. But we all know that New Mexico is a state with a lot of kids who are learning English as a second language. So it's not often as simple as a test.
The bigger question of why any child anywhere can't read by the time they're in the third grade is a real question. I mean, I'm going to guess that probably everybody sitting at this table right now learned to read by the time they were about five. I know I went into first grade already reading, and I bet a lot of people listening learned to read early. Why are there any third graders anywhere? I mean, let's say you come from Mexico, but you are so open to language learning at that age. Anybody can learn any language when they're 5, 6, 7 years old. It's not like somebody who comes in at the age of 16 or 32. What's going on with that?
Well, I think what's going on with it, again, I hate to harp on the same word of poverty, but if you go along the southern border of New Mexico where the colonias are, and kids don't have a desk with a lamp and books. They're not in a family that's reading to them or is encouraging that. They're trying to put food on the table. So if you go to abject poverty, which we have a lot of, and in the Navajo Nation would be another example, there are a lot of people who are living well below the poverty line. They don't have books. Yeah, I mean, I was reading by the time I got to kindergarten, but I was fortunate enough to be in a circumstance where I had a place to study and read, and not everybody has that. And so it's easy to be to judge and say, well, everybody can do it. Everybody probably could under good conditions, but that is one of the problems. And it's not just in New Mexico. You go to any large city where you have drugs, and go to Baltimore, go to Washington, D.C., go to Philadelphia. You will see the same sort of phenomenon where people without parents really looking out for them fall behind.
And the school, the first and second grade, just aren't imparting that. They're not like that safe space where the kids can learn to read.
Well, they do. I mean, I don't think there are too many teachers who slough off. Like any profession, you have a mixture. I mean, not all teachers are effective. Not all teachers are dedicated, but most of them are. Most of them are trying to help. But if you get a class, you've got 20 kids, 25 kids maybe, and some of them are lagging. What we really probably need are more teacher aides
and tutors
and more summer school to get people reading at a better level. All of those things cost money. The first time Susana Martinez pushed this bill to hold back thousands of third graders, it almost passed. It was blocked in the Senate by former Majority Leader Michael Sanchez, the governor's arch enemy. But that bill did not have a single penny in it for any sort of summer school or extra help. And the guy who was the superintendent in Las Cruces at the time, Stan Rounds, said, this is going to cost my district another $9 million, and I don't have the money for it. What are we supposed to do? Not follow through on other legally mandated programs that we're supposed to do and fund this? We just don't have money to devote to this. And he said he would have some schools where he would have to have 2 third grades because they're on the border or close to it. And they have kids who are not reading at that level. And so there was a lot of expense involved, but no money was put into the bill. And we cannot fool ourselves and think that money doesn't make a difference. Where are the successes in Susana Martinez's grading of schools? They tend to be schools that have strong income levels. You look in Santa Fe, Wood Gormley always gets an A. And it's a good school, but it also has kids coming from higher income levels. It's not that complicated if you look at it. And she could point to certain examples, but you can manipulate those numbers. I mean, she's pointed to one elementary school on the border with Mexico, where she says the students are achieving at high rates. The tests in those schools were given in that school were given in Spanish for a long time. So, of course, the reading scores look better. You can always find a way to make a school look better or worse under those rankings. But what really ought to be happening is support for classrooms so teachers have the resources they need to help every kid.
And then, of course, part of poverty is hunger, and as everybody knows, you can't think or learn if you're hungry.
That too.
Let's move on to what this session is actually supposed to be for in the first place, which is the budget. The 60-day sessions, supposedly, and those happen in odd-numbered years, are for passing new legislation. The 30 days are primarily about the state of New Mexico budget. What does the budget look like this year? What does it look like in the last several years?
Yeah, I mean, there's actually money this year. There's going to be more revenue coming in, which is a change from the last several years when there have been shortfalls and rounds of budget cuts, which, of course, in turn has set off political fighting, really. I mean, no one wants to see their school district get cut or their community college get cut. So it should be politically easier to craft a budget this year because there is more money. It's not a lot. I think it's somewhere in the range of $200 million right now. And that, of course, sounds like a lot of money, but you also have to realize that this is a state government with a budget of upwards of $6 billion. So you also have a number of obligations, like if the federal government doesn't renew funding for the Children's Health Insurance Program, the state plans to pick up those costs itself, but that will cost, I think, somewhere in the range of $30 million. So there's an expense right there. And you see things like that where, you know, there are a number of needs that need to be met. There are also needs from past years that have been put off because of budget shortfalls that legislators are going to try and address this year. So don't expect any big, ambitious, major spending projects this year. Everyone's really just trying to cobble together a budget and do it amicably, get raises for teachers, state workers who haven't had raises in a while, and get on with the election year. Because after all, it is an election year. I don't think people really want to be bogged down in crafting a budget, spending a lot of time at the roundhouse when they need to be out campaigning. And meanwhile, you have interest groups, I think, like teachers' unions that have certainly done battle with the governor in the past, but they know that there are raises on the table, and in about a year they'll have another governor. So I think they're ready to, you know, step back and say, we'll see what comes in a year, and maybe not take on some of the battles we've seen in the past.
Yeah, the proposals from the governor and the Legislative Finance Committee were very, very close, with, you know, half a percentage point off in certain cases. So it looks like they're in pretty good agreement with the budget, though, like I said earlier, I think by February it'll be a crisis. But Andrew's right, there's not going to be any huge new innovative things coming out of the session. And there's plenty of opportunities for political fights, just where the money should be spent, what should be financed and or refinanced.
Yeah, I think one battle to watch might be over the reserves. I mean, this is money that the state puts aside every year so that when we see a shortfall, so when, you know, expenses on a project go over budget, or when you see the price of oil drop and tax revenue falls off, we have a cushion. We have a financial cushion. Reserves have been depleted in the last few years. Now, I think there are different proposals to raise those back up in the range of maybe 8% to 10% or higher. That, I think, is where you might see some fighting. I think some advocates for public education might say, for example, that more money you put in reserves means less money for public schools. But you'll also hear folks arguing that, you know, we're a state that's so reliant on oil and gas and commodity prices that we need a particularly big cushion because we just don't know what will happen. And we don't want to be back where we were a few years ago in a special session having to cut budgets because we're suddenly facing a deficit.
Well, it sounds like if there's any extra money lying around, I mean, you guys just got done saying that the public defender's office is so woefully understaffed and there are insufficient numbers of public defenders. I mean, you don't even have to start making new programs, just hire people to do the jobs that are, like, guaranteed by the Constitution of the United States, for example.
Right. I think a lot of the money that you're going to see coming in over last year is going to be spoken for. You know, I think it's not extra money. It's money that people already have a lot of ideas about where it should go.
In one sense, I mean, when you're talking about the budget, it seems like it's kind of boring. It's kind of like, let's talk about balancing our checkbook. But the budget is really the tool for policy. I mean, the budget tells you where your money is going to be spent and what the state is about.
Well, that one of the difficulties in writing about legislatures at any state you go to, people don't relate very well. When we say a $6.3 billion budget, that is beyond the comprehension of all of us. I mean, we deal with our own households. But if you write about someone, the former Secretary of State, Diana Duran, stealing $13,000, $14,000 in campaign contributions, people can identify with those. Sometimes just the deal-making is more the story than the big number, because people can relate to one program getting cut so somebody's favorite program gets more money, as opposed to just these massive amounts. About half of that budget goes to education as it is. Yet we know we have a lawsuit right now that says we're not adequately funding education. The problem is this state has not blossomed the way Colorado has, or Texas or Arizona. Those economies are better and stronger. And that is really the essence of why we have budget problems, is we don't have a robust private economy the way border states do.
Why not? What are those states doing right? I mean, maybe not Texas, but Arizona and Colorado are in many ways comparable states to ours. What are they doing differently?
Well, I think a lot of things are different. I mean, if you look at, I used to work at the Denver Post, so I'm pretty familiar with, and I grew up in Colorado, so I know a fair amount about that state, more so than Arizona. But Colorado has put money into education. And its biggest metropolitan area is much more prosperous. It has many more private companies than the biggest one in New Mexico. The same thing is true in Arizona. Phoenix is one of the five biggest cities in the country now. And that in itself, I don't think, is an achievement, just being big. But there are jobs that pay decent money, and that's a big part of it. Here, we're still stuck on federal contracts and, to a large extent, government jobs. You know, Santa Fe.
Don't forget call centers.
Those are not the kind of sustainable jobs where you can raise a family. And that's the difference. I mean, when I go back to Denver now, I see neighborhoods that were in a sorry state are in a good position. They have been rebuilt and have people living and leading prosperous lives there. That sort of private sector work has not been accomplished here. And Colorado, in Denver in particular, also has some dependence on oil and gas, particularly as a corporate center for those. But the moves that have been made there with public transportation, with public safety, have been much better. Albuquerque has regressed. Denver has moved ahead.
To what extent did the passage of marijuana, the legalization of marijuana in Colorado, make a difference to that economy? I know it's much touted by fans of, well, medical and non-medical marijuana. Has it made a palpable difference, do you think?
Yeah, it's helped. It's raised a lot more funds even than they thought. But it's not the cure-all that the advocates imply or say it's going to be. Like, if only we legalized marijuana, we wouldn't have budget problems. We could fund education properly. And it's not going to do all that unless everybody just starts smoking a lot of dope.
Would have other consequences.
Yes.
I think you'll find plenty of critics in Colorado that neighborhoods have turned seedier than they used to be because of the marijuana, that there is much more of a transience. I hear critics all the time, people I used to work with, people I know, who say they are not satisfied that it has made life better. And there's always a cost. Senator Ortiz Pino of Albuquerque, who sponsors the marijuana legalization, recreational marijuana legalization, recently told me there are no costs. Well, there are always costs. I mean, we have liquor is legal, and we have costs with that. We have an enforcement cost. You have regulations. And it's the same with marijuana. It is certainly not a panacea. It's not, especially in this sort of state where you have so many deep problems, that you're not going to legalize recreational marijuana and see your state turn around. What you need is good education, good transportation, people who are in good jobs, paying taxes, and therefore your state is functioning smoothly. You look at the school districts that do the best, they have a good tax base. And that does not happen if you are reliant on one or two sorts of incomes, federal jobs and extraction industries. That is really where this state has not changed in the 7 years that Susana Martinez has been in office. There is really no diversification. And it didn't change probably in the 8 years before that, although I wasn't here to see how much progress was made under Bill Richardson or before that under Gary Johnson. Steve could speak to that. But there has not been the diversification of the economy that she said was necessary. She knows it. We all know it. But it hasn't happened.
Yeah, in that respect, both Johnson and Richardson failed. Richardson went in saying, we're our 49th on all these lists, and we're going to get off. And it didn't happen. Susana came in saying the same thing. So, and part of it has to do with education, and we do spend a huge chunk of the budget on education, but it's a vicious cycle. If you don't have a good education, the companies that want to hire educated employees don't come here, and so we keep depending on oil and gas and government.
One of the things that Mylon mentioned a moment ago was having good-paying jobs and a good tax base, but something that both Republican and Democratic governors seem to always want to do is cut taxes. And it's still this kind of concept of trickle-down economics that if you cut taxes, the wealthier tax bracket people will have more money to spend and they'll spend it, and somehow that will go into the hands of the poor. I haven't seen any studies that have actually supported that on the ground. And there are many that show that the contrary is true, that trickle-down simply doesn't work. But then you're put in a position where if taxes are cut, and then 8 years or 16 or 20 years later, you see that it hasn't worked, and you try to put them back to where they were before, people go bananas because they don't want their taxes raised.
Well, that's the problem. This governor, Susana Martinez, pushed hard to cut corporate taxes in 2013. The legislature did a very poor job. The Democratic leadership under Kenny Martinez went along with that. The bill was not written well. It was not debated. It was rammed through in the last minutes, or maybe even after the session. And so you have ended up with not a bigger tax base. You just cut taxes for corporate taxpayers. When I said states that do well or cities that do well have a broader tax base, it's because they have more jobs. Why is Colorado Springs a nicer place than Albuquerque? It has more jobs. And yes, there is a federal component there too. They have the Air Force Academy and NORAD and Fort Carson. They have a government base, but they also have a lot of private employers. And that's how you build a tax base, is with private sector. Here, the idea was, well, as you said, trickle down. We'll cut the corporate taxes, and then everybody will hire more people. That didn't happen. And if you go back, I just saw a quote from Lyndon Johnson from 50 years ago where he said the Republicans are obsessed with trickle down. That was 1968. And he was poo-pooing the value of it. But we keep seeing, it's kind of the same old playbook. If we just cut corporate taxes, everything will be okay. And I have yet to see it work. It certainly did not work in New Mexico. And it usually means that the middle class shrinks. That's what you get. You have a few people who get more and a lot of people who get nothing.
It's interesting to me that you're seeing candidates for governor, though, turning to talking about the permanent fund this year, rather than talking about we're going to fund these big ideas we have by raising taxes, we're going to fund it by taking a larger share of revenue from the permanent fund. And so you're seeing even candidates now unwilling to really broach this subject in a big way, and instead looking for where else can we find money in this state? Because it doesn't seem like candidates even want to go back to those tax cuts that are pretty recent.
Yeah, Richardson came in 2003 and cut corporate taxes.
Yeah. That's right.
And that was supposed to make us all happy.
Well, even the next governor will have a hard time if he wanted to undo what the Martinez administration and the legislature did with corporate taxes, because it's what you said. People will not react well to a tax increase, even if it simply brings it to the prior level. Once you make that move, you're sort of stuck with it. It is, you're not easily going to reverse that policy, even though it hasn't worked. I mean, they've said, give us a couple years and you'll see all these companies coming in. Well, we've now had four years and we haven't seen it, so.
Yeah, and ask President Mondale about promising to raise taxes. didn't work for him very well.
This has very much been, well, starting last year, kind of the year of the woman. There's been the Me Too movement. How is that, if it is, reflected in the New Mexico legislature and in New Mexico politics?
Well, I think it really put a spotlight on, first of all, how harassment is handled in the legislature. You've seen, I mean, just this week, there's going to be a, you know, a new policy that I think is more than twice as long as the old two-page policy that used to be in place. There's been a lot of people speaking out about how the, you know, previous policy was very much slanted against people bringing complaints or speaking out. And there's really been an effort to revamp that entire code. And so I think it's put a spotlight on the policies. It's also brought some people forward or encouraged some people to come forward. I think we've heard, you know, from the lobbyist Vanessa Allred discuss her own experience in the New York Times of, you know, she says a legislator, you know, threw himself at her, and we've heard
forced himself on her.
Yeah, forced himself on her. And you know, we're hearing more of those stories. But I think you're also seeing it in the way that the election is shaping up. You're seeing more women running for office, I think. And as one legislator put it, I mean, the great irony of Donald Trump's presidency could be that he gets more women in public office. For example, look at the Court of Appeals races. There are going to be 5 seats for Court of Appeals, I think, up on the ballot this year. And I think there are, on the Democratic side, 5 women, 1 running for each of those. You know, you're seeing more women running for the legislature too. And in the last election, you saw a split along party lines where you saw, you know, one woman elected to the state Supreme Court, one woman elected to the state Court of Appeals. Both were running against men. One was a Republican, one was a Democrat. It wasn't a party line vote. It seemed to be a vote very much about people, you know, perhaps wanting more representation in the judiciary, wanting more representation in Santa Fe. So I think you'll see it come across that way too.
I think this will be more the year of the woman anytime in my lifetime since 1992, which was the year after Clarence Thomas was confirmed for the U.S. Supreme Court. Those hearings with Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas generated a lot of interest in getting female voices more into office, so that they might do a better job, listen better, represent better. And I think we'll see some of that, not in every race, but in a lot of races, such as the Court of Appeals. We'll maybe see it to some degree in the congressional district in Albuquerque, where we have a couple of strong women candidates there. There's certainly no guarantee that one of them will break through, but we'll see. But I think we will also see, at least at a surface level, more civility and more quietness in the legislature. There'll be less overt attempts at kinds of things that lobbyist Vanessa Allred said happened to her.
And I think the main thing about this new policy that's good, and I'd like to see this adopted for other things beyond the harassment issue, is that it requires an outside counsel to be in on deciding whether a case is going to be investigated or not. In the past, and what people have told me, mainly women have told me, that they weren't willing to report these things because the legislature looked after it, you know, and if Senator Grabby Grab is the guy in charge of some committee or something, they're not going to, he's a good old boy, you know. But this requires an outside counsel who's versed in harassment issues to look at it. And I'd like to see a lot less foxes guarding the hen house and other aspects of the legislature, too. If the public passes the Ethics Commission amendment, that could help. Of course, the legislature always has the power to water it down. But I hope they don't.
We haven't talked about health care, Medicaid. There's apparently another anti-abortion bill that's going to be on the table that probably surely won't go anywhere. We haven't talked about the environment, water. Anything that you guys want to mention before we wrap up?
Well, I think we've covered most of these issues. I made a list before this show about things that will not pass.
What's on your list of things that will not pass?
Okay, like I say, we've discussed all of them. The death penalty. We're not going to bring back the death penalty. I doubt we pass a three strikes bill. I doubt that we drastically increase penalties for other crimes. The third grade reading bill that Mylon was talking about ain't going to happen. There will be no major changes to the tax code. And on the other side, things that liberals want, we will not legalize marijuana. And we will not dip into the reserves to fund early childhood education or anything else.
You heard it here first.
And often.
One of the things that was a kind of repetition every single year during Susana Martinez's administration until last year was driver's licenses for immigrants, and finally that is over. But I have to say that I think if there's any legacy that she left was she made it harder for citizens to get driver's licenses. Has anyone tried to get a license?
I know somebody, a good friend of mine, who was using her maiden name professionally, and she's divorced, had to go legally change her name to get her driver's license because she had a ex-husband's last name legally. So, I mean, it's, and I get, I don't know how many phone calls I've gotten from unsatisfied customers at DMV saying, what do you have to do? You know, I took in my electric bill. I took it, you know, it's a mess. I think they may have made it harder than it needed to be.
You think?
A little.
Well, I also think, though, that speaks to the ineffective legacy of Susana Martinez. In 2011, her own party gave her bills that would have solved her complaints about driver's licenses for immigrants. Don't give an immigrant who, without proof of documentation, a proof of legal status, don't give them a regular driver's license. Give them some other form of driver's license, privilege card, or whatever term you want to use. Those bills were available to her in 2011. She would not consider them. She wanted an out-and-out repeal of the bill. She stuck with that for years and years against all common sense and against her own party even, and finally caved in on it, and then we ended up with a chaotic system. This could have been handled smoothly, efficiently, and it would have saved the ordinary person trying to renew a driver's license a lot of trouble. But instead, we have, with this Real ID, it became such a monster for people. You have to have your birth certificate, you have to have a passport, you have to have a utility bill. All these from people who have been driving in this state for 30, 40, 50 years. And so that was sort of the way she operated. Instead of looking for the solution, she wanted to keep the campaign fight going on for the next election.
There was even a woman who couldn't get a license because I think she was a housewife and the bills and so on were in her husband's name. And she sued. I'm not sure what came of that. In any case, we have, I think, done our legislative preview, ladies and gentlemen. I'm really delighted to have all of you on the air, Mylon Simonich, Steve Terrell, and Andrew Oxford of the Santa Fe New Mexican. And who knows, maybe we'll meet again for a legislative wrap-up in about a month or so.
Or after that special session. Into this.
Look forward to a wrap-up, not a special session.
Yeah, really.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican. An independent newspaper since 1849, the New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.